Chapter 29.
Allah help us, muttered Ismail's driver. The crazy idiots, we can't stop them. Keep after them, Ismail shouted hysterically. Don't let them escape.
They'll die anyway. No one can survive a runaway car down a mountainside.
Ismail swung his gun barrel and roughly pushed the muzzle into his driver's ear.
Catch those pigs, he snarled viciously, or you'll see Allah sooner than you planned.
The driver hesitated, seeing death no matter which move he made. Then he gave in and turned the Mercedes down the steep incline after the cord.
Allah guide my actions, he uttered in sudden fear.
Ismail pulled the gun away and pointed through the broken windshield.
Be still and mind your driving.
Ismail's henchmen in the second Mercedes didn't pause. Dutifully, they plunged after their leader. The cord hurtled across the hard-packed snow like a runaway freight train, gaining speed at a terrifying rate. There was no slowing the heavy car. Pitt steered with a light touch and feathered the brakes, cautious not to lock them and send the cord into an uncontrollable spin. A sideways slide down the steep incline would only result in the car's overturning and ending up at the base of the mountain in a scattered trail of metal and broken bodies.
Is this a good time to raise the question of seat belts? Asked Giordino, with his feet raised and wedged against the dashboard.
Pitt shook his head. Not optional equipment in 1930.
Pitt sensed a tiny bit of luck as the bullet-shredded rubber tire tore off the rear wheel. Free of the deflated tire, the double edges of the rim gave him a small measure of control as they bit into the icy surface, throwing up fan-like sheets of ice particles. The speedometer was hovering at 60 when Pitt saw a field of moguls coming up. Expert skiers found the rounded snow bumps a favorite obstacle course. So did Pitt when he shushed down a slope at high speed. But not now, not playing downhill racer with a weighty 2,120 kilograms of automobile. With a deft touch, he gently nudged the car off to the side of the trail where the path ran smooth. He felt as though he were trying to thread a needle with an Olympic bobsled. Subconsciously, Pitt tensed himself for the violent shock and crushing impact should he make the slightest wrong move and hurl the car into a tree, smashing everyone to bloody pulp. But there was no crushing impact. The cord somehow shot through the narrow slot, the moguls on one side and the trees on the other flashing by like blurred stage sets. As soon as Pitt was on a wide, unobstructed run, he snapped his head around to check the status of his pursuers. The driver of the lead Mercedes was savvy. He'd followed in the cord's tire tracks around the moguls. The second driver either didn't see them or didn't consider them dangerous. He realized his mistake too late and compounded it by throwing the Mercedes wildly from side to side in a desperate effort to dodge the meter-high humps. The Arab actually slipped past three or four before he took one head-on. The front end dug in and the rear rose up and appeared to hang on a 90-degree angle. The car stood poised there for an instant, and then it flipped end over end as if a child had flipped a short stick. It struck the hard snowpack again and again with the splitting sound of crashing metal and glass. The occupants might have survived if they'd been thrown clear, but the jarring series of impacts had jammed the doors. The car began to disintegrate. The engine tore from its mountings and tumbled crazily into the woods. Wheels, front suspension, rear drivetrain, none of it was built to take this destructive torture. It all wrenched away from the chassis, bouncing in mad gyrations down the hill. Pitt could not spare the time to watch the Mercedes cartwheel and crumple into an indistinguishable heap before finally grinding to a halt on its squashed roof in a small ravine. Would it sound gauche, said Giordino for the first time since they plunged off the crest, if I said, one down?
I wish you wouldn't use that term, Pitt muttered through gritted teeth. The score is about to escalate.
He briefly took one hand from the wheel and motioned ahead. Giordino tensed as he observed the ski run fork and merge with another trail crowded with people in vividly colored ski suits. He jerked himself to a standing position by grabbing the remains of the windshield frame, shouting and waving frantically as Pitt laid on the cord's twin horns. The startled skiers turned at the honking and saw the two speeding cars barreling down the ski trail. With seconds to spare, they traversed to the sides and gaped in astonishment as the cord, with the Mercedes right behind, sped past. A ski jump rose from the trail and dropped off 100 meters away. Pitt hardly had time to distinguish the snowy ramp blending in with the hillside. Without hesitation, he aimed the radiator ornament at the starting drop-off.
"You wouldn't," blurted Giordino.
"Plan four," Pitt assured him. "Brace yourself. I may lose control."
"I thought you've been doing that right along."
Far smaller than the structures built for Olympic competition, the jump was used only for acrobatic and hot dog skiing exhibitions. The ramp was wide enough to take the cord and then some.
It extended 30 meters into a concave dip before abruptly ending 20 meters above the ground. Pitt lined up on the starting gate, using the cord's wide body to hide the ski jump from the view of the Mercedes. The tricky part depended on exact timing and a nimble twist of the steering wheel. At the last instant, before the front wheels rolled across the starting line, Pitt flicked the steering wheel and spun the cord's rear end, whipping the car away from the ramp down the ski jump. Alert to the sudden antics of the cord, Ismail's driver swung to avoid a collision and made a perfect entry through the starting gate. As Pitt wrestled the cord back on a straight path, Giordino looked back at the Mercedes and stared into a face masked with a weird expression of frightened rage. Then it was gone as the car shot down the steep slant out of all control. It should have soared into the sky like a fat bird with no wings. But the rear end broke loose and it slipped on a slight angle, dropping the right wheels off the ramp side a few meters before the final edge and sending the car spiraling through the air like a well-thrown football. The Mercedes must have been hitting close to 120 kilometers when it lifted off. Impelled by tremendous momentum, it twirled through sky for an incredible distance before curving earthward and striking the snowpack with a tremendous impact on its four wheels. As if in slow motion, it bounced and sailed into a tall ponderosa pine, smashing against the thick trunk. The grinding screech of mangled metal split the thin air as the chassis and body wrapped around the tree until the front and rear bumpers met like a pitched horseshoe against a steel stake. Glass exploded like confetti, and the bodies inside were twisted and mashed like flies under a swatter. Giordino shook his head in wonder. "That's the damnedest sight I've ever seen." "More to come," said Pitt. He had straightened out the cord's wild slide, but there was no slowing its velocity. The brakes had burned out halfway down the slope, and the steering tie rod was bent and hanging by a thread. The cord's path was unmistakable. It was heading toward the large ski facility and restaurant building at the base of the chairlifts. All Pitt could do was keep blowing the horns and struggle to avoid skiers too dumb to scramble out of the way. The women had watched the destruction of the last Mercedes with morbid curiosity and vast relief. The relief was short-lived. They turned and stared aghast at the rapidly approaching building. "Can't we do something?" Halla demanded. "I'm open for suggestions," Pitt fired back. He became quiet as he managed to dodge a ski class made up of young children by careening up a snowbank and curling around them. The main mass of skiers had either heard or witnessed the crash of the Mercedes and were galvanized into action at the sight and sound of the cord. They quickly moved to the side of the trail and stared in utter incomprehension as the cord rocketed by. Warnings of the runaway vehicles had been phoned from the upper end of the chairlift, and ski instructors had cleared most of the crowd away from the base area. There was a shallow frozen pond to the right of the ski center. Pitt hoped to angle in that direction and run onto the ice until it cracked open, sinking the car to the running boards and bringing it to an abrupt halt. The only problem was the onlookers had unwittingly formed a corridor leading to the restaurant. "I don't suppose there's a plan five," said Giordino, bracing himself for the collision. "Sorry," said Pitt, "we're all sold out." Lily and Hollow watched, helpless and horror-stricken. Then they dived behind the division behind the chauffeur's seat, closed their eyes, and clutched each other. Pitt stiffened as they struck several long racks holding skis and poles. The skis seemed to explode as they were sent flying through the air like toothpicks. For an instant the cord seemed buried, but then it burst clear and bored up the concrete stairway, missing the restaurant but splintering through the wooden wall of the cocktail lounge. The room had been emptied except for the piano player, who sat paralyzed at his keyboard, and a bartender, who elected discretion and frantically took refuge behind the bar, just as the cord exploded into the room and bulldozed its way through a sea of chairs and tables. The cord almost broke through the far wall and down a two-story drop. Miraculously, its momentum finally spent, the mutilated car stopped short, leaving only its badly distorted front bumper protruding through the wall. The cocktail lounge looked like the recipient of an artillery barrage. Except for the hiss of the radiator and the crackling of the overheated engine, an eerie silence filled the room. Pitt had banged his head against the windshield frame, and blood was streaming down his face from a cut above the hairline. He looked over at Giordino, who sat staring at the wall as if turned to stone. Pitt turned and stared down at the women behind. They were wearing their best "Are We Still Alive?" look, but seemed none the worse for wear. The bartender was still huddled out of sight behind the bar, so Pitt turned to the piano player, who sat in a daze on a three-legged stool. He was wearing a derby hat, and the cigarette that dangled from the side of his mouth hadn't even lost its ash. Hands were poised above the keys, his body rigid as if he was locked in suspended animation. He stared, shaken, at the bloody apparition who insanely smiled back.
"Pardon me," said Pitt politely. "Can you play Fly Me to the Moon?"